From the KGOU studios, I'm Brian Hartzinski, filling in this week for Suzette Gralat, and welcome to Worldviews. Today, Rebecca Cruz talks with ESPN founder Bill Rasmussen about establishing the first 24-hour sports broadcasting network and how it became the self-proclaimed worldwide leader in sports.
It doesn't make any difference what the language is. The picture and the sport tells its own story, and everybody understands. They don't have to understand the language just to understand the sport. It's a marvelous way to bring cultures together, I think.
But first, Rebecca and I discuss why the former African nation of Rhodesia is so important to some white supremacists in light of last week's shooting in Charleston.
They look across, look at Africa, see these, what they would claim are successful white states, and can use those as an example.
The news is next. This is World Views. I'm Brian Hartzinski, filling in again this week for Suzette Gralat. She's wrapping up a three-week trip to Italy, and she'll be back in the studio next week. We are joined again, however, by our regular panelist, Rebecca Cruz. Rebecca, I want to focus on Africa this week, and I'd like to start with an international angle on the story that's dominated the news cycle for the past week, and that's the shooting in Charleston. We've watched the conversation shift toward a debate on the Confederate flag and Southern symbols from the American Civil War that are now largely associated with racism. The man accused of carrying out this shooting, Dylan Roof, reportedly had well-documented racist beliefs, and the Confederate flag was certainly featured prominently among online photos of him. But he was also seen wearing a patch with the flags of apartheid-era South Africa as well as Rhodesia. Give me a little bit of background here. Where exactly was this country and what's its history?
Well, if we think about actually both South Africa and Rhodesia, we should be familiar with South Africa, know that it's at the bottom of Africa and go a little bit north to the country of now of Zimbabwe, which was previously Rhodesia. Both of these countries have somewhat similar pasts, so it's not a mistake or a coincidence that this young man has used them as symbols or is using their flags. Both countries came from their colonial rulers, declared independence, and then you had the white minorities in both of these countries, small minorities, very, very small percentages.
Less than 5%, right?
Very, very small, and in Rhodesia, significantly smaller than in South Africa. So you see a period of time where both of these populations in these two countries, either through legislation, through civil war, through other means, or a mix of those, are trying to solidify their role in these countries, to have a white government and to oust any influence by the black populations in both of the countries. So South Africa, again, we're very familiar with. We're familiar with the idea of apartheid. Nelson Mandela, who passed away here last year, we're familiar with his struggle and what happened there with the institutionalization of segregation and keeping blacks out of office in certain areas, keeping them from advancing in any way. Well, in Rhodesia, which is, again, just to the north of them, this a very similar pattern took place. Now, the independence was declared a little bit later. It was in the 1960s. And you do see the civil war that erupts. And again, a white leader comes out of that civil war for a period of time and implements a very, very heavy-handed ruling power on the black people in the country.
And what happened to Rhodesia?
Well, after a period of civil war in the 1970s and into the 1980s, we see that continue. And eventually, a gentleman named Robert Mugabe takes over. And eventually, again, this is declared as Zimbabwe. Now, Mugabe has been the leader of Zimbabwe since the early 1980s. He is currently still the leader. And this is an interesting thing because in the early years of Zimbabwe in the 1980s, this was seen as a very big success story. Mugabe was seen as very popular to the outside world, to the international community. Zimbabwe was kind of considered the breadbasket of Africa, and very positive things coming out of his rule. But in the last 10 years or so, the country has significantly faltered. Superinflation, corruption, political corruption, and all sorts of other issues that have caused a number of problems. And this is why this young man in Charleston is making this reference to both countries. Because he can say, particularly if we look at the current situation in Zimbabwe today, that under white rule, things were better. When they kept the black people out, things worked better. And once the blacks took over, then this has led to bad government and those sorts of things. This is obviously a falsehood. There's much more to the story than this. But that's what he's claiming, this kind of the glory days of white supremacy in these two countries.
And there was a website that was reportedly registered under Dylan Roof's name that he called the Last Rhodesian. What is it about this country's history that resonates so strongly with white supremacists? There's kind of a similar lost cause myth that is kind of a parallel to the Confederate States of America. What is it that these people embrace?
Well, think about when all of this is happening. It's the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. If you look at both South Africa and Rhodesia, Zimbabwe, again, this is happening at the same time that the civil rights movement is going on in this country. And you start to see, again, a rise of white supremacism. You know, the Ku Klux Klan becomes powerful again, and we start seeing a lot of action. So they look across, look at Africa, see these what they would claim are successful white states, and can use those as an example. Maybe it's a lost cause, but I would argue that it's more of a glory days, how things could have been and should be. Again, a myth.
And there's kind of an interesting parallel here because, as you mentioned, what was once Rhodesia is now the modern state of Zimbabwe. That country's leader, Robert Mugabe, he's 91 years old. He's been in power since 1980. He's openly compared himself to Adolf Hitler in public speeches. Why would an African leader who helped overthrow this white minority-ruled state of Rhodesia, and he even sports a toothbrush-thin mustache, how is he viewed by his people and other African leaders?
Yeah, it's an odd comparison, and I don't claim to understand exactly what he's trying to get across there, perhaps other than the fact that he does seem to have complete rule. In the elections in 2008, as the country was dealing with this superinflation, hyperinflation, there were situations of large-scale political corruption that he was implied in, and we saw attacks against his opponents, physical attacks that was never proven that he was involved, but there is a lot of speculation that he was, and yet he continues to be in power. Now, at 91, we can assume that this is not going to be a situation for very long, and that will be the really interesting question. What happens to Zimbabwe once Mugabe is gone? Also interesting, while there are many people in his country that do support him and some that don't, African countries seem to be supporting him as well, and he just recently was elected as leader of the African Union.
That's Rebecca Cruz. She's the assistant dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. It's been nice to come out from the control room while Suzette's been in Italy. She'll be back next week. Rebecca, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And we've linked to a few articles about this topic in the Worldview section of KGOU.org, where you'll also find analysis of the issues, interview transcripts, and audio from this and all of our past episodes. You can also let us know your views on the topics by leaving a comment on the Worldviews page or by sending us a tweet at WorldviewsKGOU. Coming up, Rebecca is joined by ESPN founder Bill Rasmussen to discuss the ways in which people connect through sports and the expansion of a global sports network. I'm Brian Hartzinski, and you're listening to Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Brian Hartzinski. ESPN calls itself the worldwide leader in sports, and it's hard to argue with 26 television networks internationally and broadcasts that reach more than 60 countries. Our contributor Rebecca Cruz spoke with ESPN founder Bill Rasmussen about the media company's role in helping form an international sports culture.
Bill Rasmussen, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm really excited to talk with you about the founding of ESPN, which you and your son, I understand, founded about 35 years ago. And perhaps today it seems kind of basic that we would want to have 24-hour sports. But back then, this was really, really unusual. And you really had to do some pressing the flesh to get people to understand that this was something that we all are going to want to watch. Can you maybe talk about those early days?
Yeah, it was really interesting. I was all excited. Let's go talk about 24-hour sports, and people would say, you're going to do what? That's not going to work. No, it's never going to work. I had people off the street say it's never going to work. I had business people say it's never going to work. And the one that was most impressive to me when we were looking for money was the Taft Broadcasting Company, big broadcasting company of the day, headquartered in Cincinnati, and they invited me to a board meeting to make my presentation. We had a wonderful lunch, and they were absolutely exquisitely perfect in manners and everything. We were all done. We started out, and the chairman walked me out the door, and he said, you know, we really appreciate your coming in, and figuratively, I guess, patted me on the head and said, you're a nice young man, but you realize this idea will never work. Not only that, cable television won't even be here in 3 years. Taft Broadcasting went out of business about 8 years after that conversation, so I guess cable won. So that's the kind of – it was that attitude. It was just amazing. It was so clear to me and such a mystery to other people. And it persisted as we tried to get to the cable industry and do many things.
And now ESPN has millions of viewers, several stations in the United States and abroad, in over 200 countries, I understand. Mm-hmm. There seems to be something about sports. On occasion, we do hear about conflict, but oftentimes we hear about sports bringing people together. We see it in reconciliation processes. We see people, you know, families maybe that haven't talked in quite some time, and they come together in sports. Communities that are struggling come together for the team. And we hear these stories all the time. You somehow saw this as a need in broadcasting, but what is it about sports, do you suppose, that has this effect?
Well, sports fans, if you think about it in terms of demographics, it's absolutely the largest demographic we have in the world. Northeast, Southwest, young, old, rich, poor, male, female, this just goes on and on. And when you can get fans engaged, it gives them something to think about. Back in the 60s, 70s, and so on, there was nothing to root for except your local team. There was no television. There were no televised games. So you became a fan. And I can remember my grandfather saw the 1906 Chicago White Sox-Chicago Cubs World Series, the only one ever played between those two. And he passed that on to me, and then I passed it on to my kids. So those old roots, they were fiercely fanatic about them, but it was just one little pocket. So basically, ESPN, the principal idea was let's give fans all over the country an opportunity to see not only what they're used to, but to see other teams they only hear about. In the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, the late 50s, we could only see 25 football games a week. Oklahoma, Michigan, Texas, Southern Cal were limited to three games, three appearances, period, end of story. That didn't make any difference. If Oklahoma's first three games were done in, you know, by the middle of October and they were undefeated, national championship bound and so on, you never, ever would see them again. It's crazy. I mean, are Oklahoma fans fanatic? Of course they are.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wouldn't you think that somebody in television land would say, we've got it. There's something wrong with this system. Well, basically that's what we did. We told the networks they were not doing it right.
And this was a way to bring more viewers, more people together. And I love how you mentioned that your grandfather passed that down to you, that this is a cross-generational thing, this fans of sport.
Very, very much so. And now the younger fans, with all the technology today, they can be really engaged, the fantasy sports leagues, things like that, but just following your team, you know, and most of the athletes now they all have Facebook pages and Twitter accounts, and fans can seemingly engage even though it's arm's length, but they're involved. And just let a player do something that's either good or bad, off the edges, and it just creates a tremendous amount of interest.
That's Bill Rasmussen, who established the ESPN television network in 1979. We'll hear more of Rebecca's conversation with him right after a short break. I'm Brian Hardzinski, and this is Worldviews. Welcome back to Worldviews. I'm Brian Hardzinski, sitting in for Suzette Grelot as she wraps up a trip to Italy. We've been hearing from ESPN founder Bill Rasmussen, who spoke with our contributor Rebecca Cruz. Before the break, Rasmussen told her how media has changed the ways in which fans engage in sports.
So this is something that we have seen grow and grow since it started 35 years ago, and it has certainly developed an international presence. And having traveled abroad quite a bit myself, I love that I can tune into the website and I can stay connected. And certainly people around the world have become more and more connected to sports that previously they would have had to come to the United States to watch. We can think of basketball, football, and certainly mm-hmm. baseball. Did you have this idea in mind that this was going to be a global phenomenon? I know your slogan is the worldwide leader in sports. So perhaps that was in the back of your mind.
Well, when we started, it was the Total Sports Cable Network. So it wasn't quite there because we weren't really thinking about it. It's 1984 when the America's Cup was held in Australia, and it was a technological accomplishment to bring a double satellite loop back to the U.S., even though it was 3 a.m. or something. But people watched, and they were impressed that using satellite technology we could get that done. Actually, talking about those international events, there are more fans and networks outside of the United States today than there are inside the United States, which is pretty amazing.
That is amazing. It does the opposite, too. As you said, it allows us here to get to learn more about international events, to learn more about international players. And one thing that was very apparent to me in the last 5 or so years ago was the series that ESPN did, the 30 for 30 series, to mark the 30th anniversary of ESPN. And I was just looking through the 30 original shows, and at least 5 of them were about international events or international players, things like the two Escobars, looking at how Andres Escobar and Pablo Escobar, though not related, Colombian soccer player and Colombian drug lord, how their lives were intertwined in sports and soccer. Other stories about Vlade Divac and other international players. So we get to learn about their backstories through this process.
Exactly. I was in Costa Rica a couple of weeks ago on Monday night. There was a gentleman that I was with, and he said, well, let's take a look at Monday Night Football. And it suddenly occurred, I hadn't even thought about it. I mean, it's, you know, I was down there on business. And, of course, everything was in Spanish. But you don't have – it doesn't make any difference what the language is. The picture and the sport tells its own story. And it's fascinating. So if it's soccer from South Africa or if it's baseball from New York City, it's around the world. And everybody understands. They don't have to understand the language just to understand the sport. It's just – it's a marvelous way to bring cultures together, I think.
It really is. And we're seeing more and more international players in our sports here. Basketball obviously comes to mind. I think this last season, 2013, there was a record number of international players. And here in Oklahoma, obviously, we have Thabo Sefolosha, who has left but was an international player. Mm-hmm. And Serge Ibaka, of course, and many others. I think it was 92 international players in the NBA last year. Baseball, obviously, also.
Baseball has got a tremendous percentage of South Americans, Dominicans, Japanese especially, even Taiwan. There have been several players from Taiwan who are outstanding.
This seems to have correlated with the expansion of ESPN, and I would argue that your organization played a role in this. How can we understand this proliferation of international players? Is it ESPN? Is it perhaps the Dream Team in 1992 bringing more people into basketball from around the world? Or how might you discuss that?
You know, I'm not really sure. Hockey had the Dream Teams back in the 70s. We had the famous Olympics when the Russians kept resetting the clock until they finally won the game. And that brought a lot of attention to international basketball. So this has been going on for a long time. And I think ESPN is basically just one more outlet, if you will, spreading the word. Pretty significant outlet, but it really is getting the message. And delivering sports internationally is, I don't know if you're aware, SportsCenter is delivered. We in the U.S., there are two places, Bristol and Los Angeles. But there are 13 other sports centers delivered around the world in all kinds of different languages. It's amazing.
Absolutely. So we talked about baseball and the NBA. One sport that actually hasn't had too many international players, and it's perhaps one of the more American sports, is football. But we have certainly seen attempts to make football more international. Just this year, we're seeing a number of games that are being played abroad. And we know that Commissioner Goodell has said that we will at some point have an expansion team in Great Britain. What do you think about this idea? Is that a good marketing strategy?
Well, the NFL has figured out about every way they can to gather as many dollars as they can from the American market. So I guess they want to go overseas. But they, you know, they had the European League a number of years ago, and it worked for a while, but it just didn't work. It takes a lot of talented football players to rise to the level of bringing in, you know, a full crowd in one of the big stadiums in England or wherever it might be. I suspect they're going to do it at some point. Doesn't take much longer to fly to London than it does if you're in Florida to fly and play a game in Seattle. And you get to Seattle, it's going to be noisier than it is in London. I know that. Those people are crazy in Seattle. We'll hear about that, I'm sure.
Sure. Well, it seems perhaps another sports team or another league, baseball perhaps, this would be a larger market for an international baseball mm-hmm. league or something along those lines.
I think you're probably right because baseball is in so many other markets already, and baseball is no longer an Olympic sport, but they play the World Baseball Championship every other year, and the Americans don't win because the Dominicans, the Venezuelans, the Panamanians, Japanese, of course, it just goes on and on. And when everybody has to play for their own team, it's kind of odd to see the major league players from the same team playing on 4 or 5 of those other teams. It's kind of interesting. You know, many years ago, St. Louis was the westernmost part of the league. There were only, I think only 10 cities had baseball teams. And there were only 16 teams, so it was a very, very small fan base. And when you talked about San Francisco and Los Angeles going to the West Coast, everybody thought that was terrible. It was just going to ruin the sport. Well, guess what? It didn't work that way. And now, what, 30 teams later, it's still going strong.
So as the world gets proverbially closer, perhaps we could see more international teams.
Absolutely.
Well, ESPN has really been successful because they are always kind of challenging or trying new things, new innovations, going to the internet, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. What's next? I know you're advising them, no longer necessarily leading, but what do you see in the future for ESPN?
You know, that's a really tough question. You just touched on something, though, that is part of the culture. I was in Dallas, I guess, about a year ago right now, and ESPN Dallas is opened as one of their five regional markets, and they basically took over some ABC studio space. And one of the people that they retained was the guy that was in charge of the ABC radio operation when it was there, and he was now working with the new ones. And I said to him, what's the difference between the two? And he said, that's easy. I thought, that's going to be an interesting answer. He said ABC was ruled by New York, and they said to everybody outside of New York City, whatever you do, don't rock the boat. ESPN has said, whatever you want to try, try it. If it works, great. We'll do it other places. If it doesn't, cut your losses and move on. And I think that's what has made ESPN grow, and I think they'll continue to do the same thing. Every piece of technology that comes along, there's somebody there that has a lot of experience, and they will keep trying and challenging. A fact that not many people realize is we went on the air in 1979. 30 years later, we went on the air with 80 people. 30 years later, 40 of those 80 were still there. Can you imagine the man hours of experience built into those 40 people? You can't ask a question that they can't answer.
Well, that's remarkable. Creativity and willing to take a risk and move forward. And we certainly will look forward to seeing what comes next. I know I will, and I know our listeners will. Thank you so much, Bill Rasmussen, for being with us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Rebecca Cruz's conversation with Bill Rasmussen, who started the process of launching ESPN in 1978 with his son, Scott. If you missed any part of their conversation, we have this episode on our website, kgou.org. where you can find all of our past shows and subscribe to our weekly podcast. Worldviews is a production of KGOU with support from the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Symphony Swift conducts the research for our show, and Sam Dupre writes our digital content and produces the show. Suzette Grillot will be back next week. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Brian Hartzinski.